Good morning, everyone.
So I'm told that we actually finished the Book of Death last week and moved on into part three of the poem. Sri Aurobindo has divided his poem into three parts. The first part takes us from Book 1, Canto 1, up to the end of Book 3, and then the second part takes us from the beginning of Book 4 up to here, up to death in the forest. So now we'll be starting Part 3 with Book 9, and that takes us to the end of the poem. Book 9 is called The Book of Eternal Night. And perhaps we reached the top of page 576 last week, line 175 on page 576. So we're trying to record, as part of our session, the readers and the questions. So if it's your turn to read, Suresh will come and hold the microphone for you. So you can wait until he gets to you and then read. And if you have any question, you can raise your hand and we'll do the same thing. Your question will be recorded. I hope that's not too disturbing to anybody. So we can start reading from line 175 on page 576, the top of page 576. But before we start, I'm a little thrilled to share with you that the next volume of The English of Savitri, I got a copy. Sorry, can you speak a little louder?
I was wondering, did we read this first part of Canto 1? Because I just don't remember, but I need to...
I'm told that we did. I don't remember it. I thought that we stopped at the end of Book 8.
Yeah?
We read some of Book 9, Canto 1, but I don't know where we stopped.
We stopped at 574, page 575, in line.
The top line.
At the bottom of 575, we stopped there.
Okay.
And so I thought we were starting again with page number 576, because when I reviewed the video, we stopped at the bottom of page 575.
Shall we do that then? Yes, but before we start, I just want to tell you how happy I am that the latest volume of English of Savitri, here this is the first copy, and this is volume 7. It covers book 2, cantos 5 and 6. We're gradually trying to cover the whole poem in these volumes, and our first target is to cover the whole of canto 2. So here we're gradually getting towards it. There are 15 cantos in Book 2. So here, this covers cantos 5 and 6. Slowly we're getting there. So these will be on sale at our desk within a few days' time. Yes, Dinika.
As I'm pretty new to everything here, I've been
coming
only since 1 year now, what is in the book? Do you explain everything or what? I'm totally innocent.
What I've tried to do is to follow the poem. We've been following the poem. And to explain, first of all, the vocabulary and the syntax. You know, what is the form of the sentence? And the imagery. And so we do it kind of paragraph by paragraph as we read the poem, these explanations are given. And people seem to be finding them very helpful. I started choosing certain books which I thought would be helpful. So we started with the Book of Beginnings that has been published. And then I think I skipped and went to Book 3, the Book of the Divine Mother. And then I went on to Book 7, which tells about Savitri's yoga. And then Book 10, the Book of the Double Twilight, where she, at the end of that canto, she finally overcomes death, the power of death. And Then I think the sixth volume we've done is covers book 11 and 12, the end of the poem. But then people started saying, no, 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 you have to cover the whole poem. And the demand was, first of all, for book 2 to be covered. So that is what we're in the process of doing now. Here's volume 7. Volume 8 is in the press. It should be coming out soon. And I'm working on editing volume 9, which covers cantos 10 and 11 of book 2. Those are two big cantos, and it'll be a fat book. But then the next book will cover cantos 12, 13, 14, and 15, and bring us to the end of book 2. And then I think I only need one more volume to cover the rest of the book. So that's the plan, if sanction is given and help is given, blessings from above, then perhaps by this time next year we might have the whole set. So here's volume 7, and as I say, it will be on sale soon from Sabda and from our own desk here. This is just the first copy that came to me yesterday. Who has given us these beautiful flowers? Is it from you, Sudanya? Yeah, thank you. We are on page 576, top line. Then Death the King leaned boundless down. And I'm going to start reading this way. So that means starting with you, please, Eugen.
When yet the mind, a passionate learner,
Top of page 576.
Then Death the King leaned boundless down, as leans night over tired lands when evening pales, and fading gleams break down the horizon's walls, nor yet the dust grows mystic with the moon. The dim and awful Godhead rose erect, from his brief stooping to his touch on earth, and, like a dream that wakes out of a dream, forsaking the poor mould of that dead clay, another luminous Satyavan rose, starting upright from the recumbent earth, as if someone over viewless waters stepped, emerging on the edge of unseen worlds.
Let's pause there. So we've reached the point in where death has come and taken the soul of Satyavan out of his body. Satyavan's body was lying in Savitri's lap because as soon as he got this terrible attack of pain, he asked her to take him on her lap because he felt that her touch might save him. But actually he knew that he's dying now. And she knew because she was expecting and waiting for this moment. And the poet has described for us this presence of death. But anyway, now death has taken Satyavan's soul and is leading him away. When he touches the ground like that, then Satyavan, a new luminous Satyavan, emerges from the body. Another luminous Satyavan arose, starting upright from the recumbent earth. He'd been lying on the ground. Now the soul, or the subtle body, stands up. And it's as if somebody has stepped over borders, a borderline that can't be seen. And he's emerging there on the edge of unseen worlds. Anybody would like to ask anything? So we'll go on from there. Manoha?
In the Earth's day, silent marvel stood between the mortal woman and the god. Such seemed he as if one departed came wearing the light of a celestial shape, splendidly alien to the mortal earth. The mind sought things long loved and fell back foreign from unfamiliar views, beheld yet long by the sweet radiant form unsatisfied, incredulous of its too bright things of heaven. Too strange the brilliant fantasy to life's clasp, desiring the world and creation of the earth, rarer in the actual or material sense. The senses cease in vain, glorious shame. Only the spirit moves, spirit still, and the heart divine, the old love heart, though changing.
Thank you. So this luminous Satyavan is wearing a wonderful form, a celestial form. The poet says, the mind. I think this must be Savitri's mind. The mind is looking for the form long loved, but that's not what is seen, that's not what is perceived. The mind is baffled. It sees unfamiliar colors. It sees this form, longs for this form, but it's not satisfied by this shade, this sweet, radiant form. It's unsatisfied. It doesn't believe in these two bright hints of heaven. It's too strange for earth life. Only her spirit, Savitri's spirit, recognizes this beloved spirit of Satyavan. Her heart senses, like divining, you know, like the diviner finds water where it can't be seen. She can feel Satyavan's heart, which she loves so much, even though its form, its physical form, has changed. Sudhanya.
Between two realms is to not worry, but fixed in quiet, strong expectancy, like one who, sightless, listening for a command. So are they immobile on that earthly or not of earth, though one in human play. On either side of one, two, spirit, stroke, silence, battle with silence, vast with vast.
Thank you. So he stood between two realms. He stood. This is Satyavan's shade, the soul, the subtle body. He's not wavering, he's not uncertain. He's fixed in quiet, strong expectancy. He's waiting calmly for something to happen, like one who, a blind person, who's waiting to hear a command, and then he will know what to do next. So there they are, the three of them, Savitri, Satyavan, Death, standing immobile on that earthly field. They're still in the material world. But these are powers that don't belong to the earth, even though one of them is still wearing human clay. Savitri is still wearing her material body. And these two spirits, Death and Savitri, are struggling against each other. They are waging a kind of silent battle. On either side of one, of Satyavan, two spirits stroll. Silence battled with silence. Vastness with vastness. Would you read them?
Now the impulse of the path was felt, moving from the silence it had supposed to touch, the confine of the visible world, luminous, he moved away. Behind him, Death, strange glory, with his noiseless tread. As seen in a dream, there is face of shadowy, handsome, clear
glides.
Horseman glides. Behind some wanderers from his voiceless herds, and Savitri moved behind eternal Death. Her mortal pace was equaled with the gods. Wordless, she traveled in her lover's steps, planting her human feet where his heart trod into the perilous silence beyond.
Yes. So first the three are just standing there, but then the impulse of the path was felt. This is something that must happen when the subtle being leaves the body. It feels attracted to new worlds. The impulse of the path was felt, moving from the silence that supports the stars to touch the confines, the limits of the visible world. Satyavan moves. He begins to follow the path. So luminous in this light body which he's wearing, he moved away. And death follows him. And Sri Aurobindo gives this wonderful image, death following Satyavan in his subtle body, slowly moving away, silently. Sri Aurobindo says, it's like seeing somebody in a dream, a shepherd, a herdsman, who is silently moving behind one of his sheep or his goats that has wandered away from the rest of the flock, so behind some wanderer, behind his voiceless herds. These are subtle sheep and goats. So Satyavan's moving first, and then death, and Savitri move behind eternal death. Her mortal pace was equaled with the gods. Sri Aurobindo's reminding us that Savitri is still in her mortal body, her body that is subject to death. Her mortal pace, her step of her physical body, she keeps up with this god of death who's moving ahead of her. Without a word, she's simply following where Satyavan has stepped. Wordless, she traveled in her lover's steps, planting her human feet where his had trod. She's not following death, she's following Satyavan, and she's following him into the perilous silences beyond, the frightening, dangerous, unknown realms that lie ahead. Yes, yes.
Satyavan is first and followed by death and then Savitri.
Yes.
Satyavan knows where to go.
He's feeling this impulse of the path into the subtle worlds. And I'm assuming this means that when we have to leave the body, it's indicated to us where we have to go next. And he's following that impulse of the path. And death is following behind him and making sure that he sticks to the path. And Savitri is not going to lose sight of them. She will follow as far as she can. Tuan, would you read?
At first, in a blind stress of woods, she moved with strange, inhuman paces on the soul, journeying as if upon an unseen road. Around her, on the green and imaged earth, the flickering stream of forest drained her steps. Its thick, luxurious obstacle boughs busied her body, pressing dimly through in a rich realm of whisper spell, and all the moon's beauty of the leaves rippled around like an emerald rock, but more and more this grew an alien sound, and her cold, intimate body seemed to her a burden which her being remotely moved. Herself lived far in some uplifted sea, where to the transplant vision of pursuit, soul presences in a high, spaceless dream, the luminous spirit glided stilly on, and the great shadow traveled vague behind. Still, with an arduous crowd of seeking hands, softly entreated by their old desires, her senses felt earth close and gentle, cling round them, and in troubled branches knew uncertain dreadings of a fainful wind. She bore dim fragrant, far-calling stars. The wild bird's voice and its wind whistle came as if a sign from some forgotten world.
Thank you. She feels the bushes and the trees that she has to pass through. Her body is still aware of that. All the murmurous beauty of the leaves rippled around her like a wonderful green robe which is clothing her. But more and more this rustle the sounds of the birds and the animals become something distant, a burden, something heavy. Her being is carrying it somehow at a distance. She herself, her consciousness, is living far away from these material scenes, in some uplifted scene, in that in her consciousness, she's only aware of these presences, Satyavan, death, herself, as if they're moving in this high, spaceless dream. In front, the luminous spirit of Satyavan is gliding silently onwards. And behind, the great shadow traveled, this shadow of death. But still, it's as if this material world is holding on to her with an amorous crowd of seeking hands holding on to her, as if calling her back, softly entreated by their old desires, the desires that the physical senses have. No? Her senses felt earth's close and gentle air cling round them, and she knows that she's disturbing the branches as she passes, no? These uncertain treadings of a faint foot wind she can feel. She still can get the fragrances of the forest, and she can hear the animals and birds, the wild bird's voice, and the rustle of the bird's wings. And that's as if it's just a faint sigh from a forgotten world.
What does stilly mean?
Stilly. It's like still means without movement. No? Stilly. It's not making any noise or discernible movement. I think we don't usually use this word, but in a still way.
Earth stood aloof, yet near. Round her it wove its sweetness and its greenness and delight. Its brilliance, suave of well-loved vivid hues, sunlight arriving to its golden noon, and the blue heavens and the caressing soil. The ancient mother offered to her child her simple world of kind, familiar things. But now, as if the body's sensuous hold, curbing the godhead of her infinite walk, had freed those spirits to their grander road. Across some boundaries intangible bar, the sight of God grew mighty and remote in other spaces, and the soul she loved lost its consenting nearness to her life. Into a deep and unfamiliar air, enormous, windless, without stir or sound, they seemed to enlarge away, drawn by some wide, pale distance from the warm control of earth, and her grown far. Now they would escape.
Thank you. I want to draw your attention to line 250. Sunlight arriving to its golden noon. It's a feature of the whole poem that Sri Aurobindo always lets us know what time of day it is, because this story is just happening in one day, from the dawn at the beginning of the book to the nightfall at the end of the book. And every now and then, Sri Aurobindo reminds us. So Satyavan, traditionally, in the traditional story, death comes to take the soul of Satyavan away at noon, at the hottest time of the hottest day of the hottest month of the year. And so here we have this, at this moment, it's just becoming noon. The sun is rising up to its zenith. And it's as if at that moment, she begins to feel that she's failing to keep up with them. No? It's as if the fact that she's still aware of her body is letting those spirits get away from her. They has freed those spirits to their grander road, and there's some boundary has been crossed. So this, the God she the god of death, who has been following Satyavan, and she's following him. And the silent god grew mighty and remote in other spaces, unearthly spaces. And Satyavan's soul, she's been in contact with his soul the whole time. But now the soul she loved lost its consenting nearness to her life. Satyavan seems to get further away. They seem to be moving into a deep and unfamiliar air that is enormous, windless, without stir or sound. They seem to enlarge away. They get bigger and they're moving further away, escaping. They're being attracted by some wide, pale distance, and they're getting very far away from the warm control of Earth and from her, from Savitri. So there's a sense of alarm that now they're going to escape from her. She's not going to be able to continue following Satyavan. So something rather dramatic happens. Paula. Sorry? Swa. Manoha, can you tell us anything about swa? It seems to me Italian, I don't know. But it smooth, and can be kind of comforting. So, line 266, Paula.
Then flaming from her body's nest alarm, her violent spirit soared at Satyavan, out mid the plunge of heaven-surrounded rocks. So in a terror and a wrath divine, from her vibrating streams against the ascending death, indignant at its crouching point of steel. A fierce she-eagle threatened in her brood, born on a rush of puissance and a cry, outwinging like a mass of golden fire. So on the spirit's flaming outrush born, she crossed the borders of divine sense, like pale, discarded sheets dropped dully down. Her mortal members fell back from her soul. A moment of a secret body's sleep. Her trance knew not of sun or earth or world. Thought, time, and death were absent from her grasp. She knew not self. Forgotten was Savitri. All was the violent ocean of a will, where lived captive to an immense caress, possessed in a supreme identity, her aim, joy, origin, Satyavan alone.
Thank you. An eerie. It is the nest of an eagle. So if people go hunting the eagles, the mother eagle will fly up and attack. Something like that, surging up out of the nest of her being. Savitri rushes out. She crossed the borders of dividing sense. And her mortal members, her physical body, which is subject to death, falls back, falls off the soul. So there's a moment of trance, a moment of a secret body sleep, and her trance, she no longer is aware of sun or earth or world, thought, time, and death. These are all gone from her consciousness. The only thing, she's not conscious of herself at all. Savitri was forgotten. All that she's aware of, all that she is this violent ocean of a will which is holding on, which is holding captive in an immense caress, Satyavan. She's holding on to him, possessed in a supreme identity, a oneness. The only thing that matters is her aim, her joy, her origin, the source of her being, Satyavan alone. He's her sovereign, her lord, but she's imprisoned him in the very core of his being, her being. So there he's beating like a rhythmic heart. He is herself. She's identified with him, but still different. One love, enveloped, clasped, a treasure saved from the collapse of space. Everything has collapsed. Only Satyavan held firmly captive in her heart. That's the only thing that exists for her. Ram Narayan.
Ram him, nameless, infinite, ceaser, a spirit fulfilled in his spirit, rich with all time, as if love's deathless moment had been found, a pearl within eternity's white shell. Then, out of the engulfing sea of trance, our mind grows drenched to light, streaming the hues of vision, and awake once more to time, return to shape the lineaments of things, and leap in borders of the sea even known. And world the tree still move in our soul sea, as if passing through fragments of a dream, she seemed to travel on, a vision shape, imagining other muses like herself, by them imagined in their lonely sleep, ungrasped, unreal, yet familiar, old, like flecks of unsubstantial memory, scenes often traversed, never leaving fled past her unheeding to forbidden roads. In voiceless regions they were travelers, alone in a new world where souls were not, but only living moons. A strange husk weird friendly was around them, strange far skies above, a doubting space where green objects meet. Within themselves, their one unchanged idea.
Thank you. So Savitri has left her mortal body now. Her mortal members fell back from her soul. She's escaped from the physical body, holding on to Satyavan alone. She's surrounding him, holding him tight, as if in love's deathless moment. But then her mind again becomes active, moves out of this trance, out of the engulfing sea of trance. Her mind rose, drenched to light, streaming with hues of vision, and she becomes awake once more to time and becomes aware of shapes and forms. Her mind returned to shape the lineaments, the outlines of things, and it lives on the borders of things seen and known. So she wakes up out of this trance into the awareness of the three of them, still moving as if within herself, in her soul scene. And she herself seems to travel on like a figment of imagination, fragments of a dream. She's a vision shape like other vision shapes, imagining other dreaming figures like herself. They are imagining her and she's imagining them. And there are certain scenes that seem familiar, but they are moving away. They're going past her, unheeding, not taking any notice of her, to forgotten goals, things that they have forgotten and she has forgotten. So now they are travelers in voiceless regions. It's silent. Perhaps dreams are often silent. No? They're aware of figures and things happening and so on, but the sound might be missing. The three of them are alone in a new world where there aren't any souls, but only living moods. Dinaka, would you read?
Weird were the grasses, weird the treeless plains, weird when the road, which like fear haste them towards death, of which it has most terror, fast the battle between pillar conscious rocks, somber and high, weeds brooding, whose stone thoughts lost their huge sense beyond in giant night. Enigma of the unconscious sculptural sleep, symbols of the approach to darkness old, and monuments of her titanic reign, opening to depths like dumb, appalling jaws that wait a traveler down a haunted path, attracted to a mystery that slays. They watched across her road, cruel and still. Sentinels, they stood of dumb necessity. Huge heads of vigilant and solemn gloom, carved muzzle of a dim, enormous world.
Thank you. It's quite a picture, isn't it? Weird, strangely magical. The grasses are weird. Treeless plains they seem to be moving through are weird. And the road they're following, it's like, Sri Aurobindo says, it's like fear hurrying towards that of which it has most terror, that which it fears most. They reach these phantasmal gates, pillared, conscious rock. Somber and high, gates that are brooding, waiting for something to happen. These rocks are conscious. They have stone thoughts, but the extent of those thoughts gets lost, their meaning gets lost in this gigantic night, this darkness. These rocks seem to express an enigma, a mystery, the mystery of the sleep of the inconscient. But they have forms, it's as if they are sculptured. These rock gates are symbols of the approach to darkness, old darkness that has been there forever. Monuments to the titanic reign of darkness. These pillared conscious rocks are watching across Savitri's road, the path she must follow. Cruel and still, they are sentinels, guardians of dumb necessity, of what has to be, what cannot be avoided. They are silent, mute heads of vigilant and sullen gloom. Vigilant means watchful. Sullen, bad-tempered, actually. Sullen. This gloom, this darkness is threatening. It's not friendly at all. These rocks, these pillared, conscious rocks, seem like the carved muzzle of a dim, enormous world. A muzzle is the mouth of a wild animal. Patricia.
Yes. Then to that chill, seer, heavy line arrived, where his feet touched the shadowy marshes spring, turning, arrested him as such a one, looked back with his wonderful eyes at Savitri. But death pealed forth his vast, abysmal cry. O mortal, mortal, turn back to thy transient kind. Aspire not to accompany death to his home, as if thy breast could live where time must die. Think not thy mind-born passion strains from heaven to uplift thy spirit from this earthly base and break it out from the material cage, to uphold thy feet of grief in groundless mort and bear thee through the pathless infinite. Only in human limits man's life safe. Trust not in the unreal laws of time, immortal deeming this image of thyself, which they have built on a dream floating ground. Let not thy dreadful goddess move thy soul to enlarge thy vehement trespass into worlds where it shall perish like a helpless thought. Know the cold germstones of thy hopes in life, armed vainly with the idol's borrowed mind, dare not to outstep man's bound and measured force. ignorant and stumbling in Greece boundaries pent. He crowns himself the world's mock sovereign, tormenting nature with his works of might. O sleeper, dreaming of divinity, wake, trembling with the indifferent silences in which thy few weak chords of being die. Impermanent creatures, sorrowful form of time, your transient love binds not the eternal gods.
Thank you. So when they come to those gates, Satyavan turns back and looks at Savitri. Satyavan's in front. Death, Savitri. And death, he has a terrible voice, a loud, terrifying voice. Death pealed forth his vast, abysmal cry, that cry which seems to express dark depths, emptinesses, deep, dark depths. Perhaps this is the first time he's speaking to her. Yeah, he's telling her to turn back. Don't think that you can follow me, death, to my home. As if your breath, your human breath, could live where even time must die. And don't think that your mind-born passion, your love for Satyavan, gives you a heavenly strength that can uplift your spirit from its earthly base as a human body. Don't think that you can break out of your material body and your spirit can lift your feet of dream up on this groundless nothingness to carry you through the infinite where there is no path to follow. He tells her human beings can only live safe within human limits. Don't trust, he says, the unreal lords of time. He must be thinking of appearances. Don't think that this image of yourself, your body, can be immortal. Don't let the dreadful goddess, he knows that she has bowed down to Durga in the morning, praying for her protection. Don't let that dreadful goddess move your soul to go further, to enlarge your trespass. You're trespassing, you're moving in spaces where you should not be. Don't let her give you courage to go further into those spaces, those worlds where you are just going to perish like a helpless thought. Become aware of the cold termstones, the limits, the unchangeable limits of your hopes in life. Here you are, you've armed yourself. In vain you have armed yourself with ideals, the borrowed strength of ideals. Don't dare to step beyond the boundaries of human life, human existence. Man's force is ignorant, stumbling, restricted in brief and very limited boundaries, but still it thinks that it's the lord of the world. Human beings, we think that we are the peak of creation. But what we're doing, he says, is just tormenting nature with the works of mind. Can accept that maybe, that mind is doing, our mental way of seeing things is doing a lot of harm to nature. He tells her, you're a sleeper. You're just dreaming of divinity. Now it's time to wake up. Realize that you're surrounded by these indifferent silences in which your few weak chords of being have to die. They can't go on existing. You human beings are just impermanent creatures, sorrowful foam of time, just like bubbles on the sea of time, which will float up and burst. Your transient loves, your short-lived loves, can't bind the eternal gods. It's like death saying, I'm an eternal god, and I am not bound by your dreams.
This is interesting that he calls the dreadful goddess.
Yes.
He's protecting all the things.
Well, of course, in a word, way, Durga is often the dreadful goddess, slaying the asuras and the enemies and so on. But he's emphasizing that side of her being. But he says, still she won't be strong enough to conquer me.
It means
suzerain. Suzerain. Yes, we had it a few weeks back. It's a form of sovereign. It's an old form in old English. Maybe has come from French, I think, perhaps. Mm. Yeah.
So now another weird question is that when Satyavan's soul left the body, as it is explained, it is bright.
Full of light, yes.
Full of light. And now it says that look back with his wonderful eyes at Savitri. So that means this luminous soul again has face, ears, yeah, eyes, and everything.
Yes, yes. It looks just like Satyavan, but Satyavan in a body of light. And he remains in that body of light as we go on. Is it okay?
No, soul again, you know, soul didn't have any form.
I think it has a form. It looks just like Satyavan. Okay. But it's a body of light, not a body of matter. Yeah? Eberhard, you'd like to read?
The dread voice ebbed in the consenting hush, which seemed to close upon it, white, intense, a wordless sanction from the jaws of night. The woman answered not. Her high, nude soul, stripped of the girdle of mortality, against fixed destiny and the proofs of law, stood up in its sheer will, a primal force, still like a statue on its pedestal, lone in the silence and to vastness barred.
Yeah.
Against midnight's dumb abysses piled in front, a columned shaft of fire and light she holds.
The dread voice ebbed. This is what the sea does. It draws away. In the consenting hush, silence comes in. Silence seems to close upon that dreadful voice. A wide, intense silence. A wordless sanction from the jaws of night. It's as if that darkness is saying yes to these words of death. But Savitri does not answer. The poet shows us a beautiful picture of Savitri's soul. Her high, nude soul has been its girdle, its belt of mortality, of death, has been taken away from it. This is her immortal soul, and it's able to rise up against what seems to be fixed destiny, that Satyavan must die. She's still contesting this. And the grooves of law, these fixed lines on which the laws of the universe seem to move. Her soul stands up in its sheer will, a primal force. It's as strong as death and time and space. She looks like a statue on a pedestal, still alone in the silence, exposed to all this vastness. But against this, these dumb abysses, these dark, deep spaces of midnight, which seem to be piled up in front of her, those dark gates, she rises up like a columned shaft of fire and light.
Ah, yeah, it's used to the midnight to explain before mid-noon.
Yes.
What is the meaning then of the wider understanding of the midnight star?
Yeah, midnight is the darkest time of the night. No. So it's not in the timescape of the story, it's not that, it's noon, But as far as this subtle world which she's being led through is concerned, it is like an embodiment of midnight, of the darkest possible time. Those rocks, they're black and threatening. Oh, it's a solidified midnight obstructing her way. Okay? In poetry, midnight, it refers to somehow that time, the darkest time of the night. Mm.
Satyavan, this luminous being, that is the soul, we say, is his body. Can we also say that each one of us has that luminous being, which is...
Yes, I think so. I think so. Yes.
The psychic being is a small part.
No, the psychic being, it's very interesting. Do you remember at the end of Canto 7, we had this, that and when Savitri meets her soul, there's the great soul, the great mother, and then that great soul embodies itself as a little being no greater than the thumb of man, which seats itself in our heart to give us the strength to face all the things that we have to face. So there's the great soul, what I think Sri Aurobindo calls the central being, and then there's the individualized soul. And these can unite, and that has happened for Savitri, that union with her fully divine being that happens at the end of Canto 5.
And I wonder if this luminous Satyavan is his subtle body, his subtle physical. And the fact that he dies at noon is like, that's the highest point, but then after that it's all decline towards sunset.
Yes, it gets dark.
So that is why it would happen then, not at midnight. No?
Yes. No, the midnight is not a time here. It is that image of the darkest moments. Mm. Yes?
A couple of lines caught my attention. Death is advising us not to torment nature, works of the mind. And so it's just a theoretical question. What is death's relationship or deal with nature?
You can't trust anything he says.
Yeah, and then I'm looking at, this is so interesting to me, 576. When death became released, boundless down.
He's so huge.
And briefly touches the earth, mm-hmm. briefly, and then rises from his brief stooping to his touch on earth.
Yes, but when he leans boundless down, it's like night, the night coming down on the earth. Hmm? It's like leaning down night over tired lands when evening pales. No, it's the stooping down of darkness.
So this touch is not a literal touch. I mean, it says he rises up, but it's not like a touch, somehow of acknowledgement or respect.
He says his brief stooping to his touch on earth. He touches the earth, and that's touching the material world. And with that touch, it's somehow as if he draws Satyavan's soul out of the physical body.
And it's that, for me, as we read through this, Satyavan is totally released from everything by that touch. These processes in the planes that Savitri now has to go through that have been described. It was just my sense of the word. Satyavan is totally free.
He's freed from the body. Mm.
Yes.
I think we have to assume that he's at least partially conscious of what's going on. Mm-hmm, yeah. Because afterwards, when we get to the epilogue, then we see that, oh yeah, he remembers some of what has happened. He asks her about it. And, conscious movement, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
That line about tormenting nature with the works of mind, the divisiveness of mind, is an agent of death.
Yes.
It causes. causes things to be destroyed.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. We have to transcend mind and get to the unity that's beyond it. If we're going to conquer death.
Or surrender to the
force. Yeah, that is surrender to that spirit which is one.
Mm-hmm. It's the secret word.
Spirit of Auroville.
The secret words.
Perhaps we'll stop there for today. Thanks to Sherwin.